Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Lulu Miller, a Peabody Award-winning science reporter and co-founder of NPR's Invisibilia. We're talking about her new book, Why Fish Don't Exist, a story of loss, love, and the hidden order of life. Lulu, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
So great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm gonna put this out here to the audience, is that there's a flow to this book that's important, that's crucial to the writing and the subject matter of the book. And I don't want to give away a lot of stuff in the book, and there's some huge issues in this book. So we're going to avoid some topics. But I want to mention for the audience, get the book and read it, because there's some really important stuff in here that we're not going to talk about.
Great. I appreciate that. Because, you know, sometimes when it's just a science-y flavored book, people think it's okay to give away the endings. But my dream was that it read kind of like a thriller. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it has that sort of podcast sensibility. So yeah. That you really – and there's some big surprises that come out. And there's weird – I'll just mention this. There's murder stuff in here.
There is. There is totally murder stuff in here, which I did not see coming when I
started. No, nor did I as the reader.
Yeah.
And so that's worth the price of admission alone. Before we get into it, I also want to mention there's some beautiful illustrations here by Kate Samworth. And she did these full-page illustrations heading up every section. And those are amazing.
Yeah, that has been my favorite part of this whole experience. So she was an artist. She's a friend and an artist. She used to be in a punk band, then she turned to illustration.
You don't know what band did?
Oh, there were so many. It was like in the 80s. Oh my gosh! And one is slipping my mind, but I will.
Well, if you remember, please do.
It's amazing.
But she's done these incredible, scratchboard illustrations.
Yeah, and they're just like. She is so talented, and when I pitched, you know, would you be a part of this, she jumped at the idea, and she just enriched the experience. I mean, she just, I gave her no guidance. That was her number one rule. She said, I'll do it, but don't give me any input.
Mm-hmm.
and she just extracted these magical images out of each chapter, and it was so cool to see how she spun, you know, because the book is 100% nonfiction, but she really pulled out the magic and the eeriness in it.
This is a complex book, and there's several threads that sort of wind in and out of the book. One of them is the looming forces of chaos in our life, your life in particularly, and how we deal with that reality. And I want to talk about your father.
Yes.
I have to say, I think I saw a lot of myself in your father, your description of your father, which I don't know if it's good or bad. But you asked your father, you're a little girl. I think you're on the Cape. I figure where you are. And you ask your father, what's the meaning of life? What was his response?
He took a big pause, and then he turned to me and he said, nothing. And then he went on to this like diatribe that he clearly had stored up, where he gleefully kind of just executed any sense of meaning or magic or mystery, not mystery, but meaning or magic. And he said, there's no point to life. There's no God. There's no afterlife. There's no purpose, no plan. Anyone who tells you there is lying and trying to comfort themselves against the fact that none of this matters and we don't matter. But the truth is none of this matters and we don't matter. And he just went on and on kind of just saying that we were basically, you know, humans are totally insignificant. We're a speck on a speck on a speck when you think about us from the universe. And, we're no more important than an ant. And then I remember he paused. And then he was like, although, do I see you aerating the soil or you know, accelerating the process of decomposition of wood, as ants do? No. So maybe you're less significant to the planet than an ant. And he just took glee. But he's a really joyful guy, if you saw yourself.
Well, that's right. It was that part of it. But that's a big enchilada to dump in a kid's lap.
It was. And it was so... there was no ambiguity. Like, it was his own dogma. It was his own atheist dogma that he was just utterly sure and utterly content to make this fact and not his opinion or his belief. He just dumped it on there. And, you know, I remember just being really stunned that, just to have that so nakedly pointed out in that way. I didn't know it at the moment, but later I think it would become a big sort of defining moment for
me. I almost want to say, how could it not be when your father tells you that? But, you know, the corollary to that, and you write about this in the book, is, yeah, you don't matter, so live as you please. But while other people don't matter either, treat them like they do.
Right. Yeah. And I think that was his sort of the lie he permitted himself to form a kind of morality. You know, on one hand, he's a hedonist in the sense of just loving all tastes. You know, he loves swimming. He'll jump in, you know, he's a polar bear club kind of guy. He'll jump into the water in the winter. He'll taste anything and everything. Because that's the point, to get it all in before we're dead. But then also he's really good to people, and he loves his student. He's a biochemist and, you know, professor, and he loves his students. They would stay with us. They'd come to holiday meals. He's like, gets my mom coffee every morning.
Oh, wow.
Has done so. You know, he's a good dude. I think he lives both of these things, kind of, you know, hedonism. I think of it as like moral hedonism, basically. taste the world and be good to people, and that's his purpose, I think.
Well, that's one of the criticisms from people of faith, of atheists, that they can't have morals. But your father's a great example, and I know many others too, of people who are atheists but do have very definite morals.
Yeah, and that's one thing, you know, for as he could be, you know, I now in retrospect I think he's way too hard on people who are religious. And that's one thing I really admire so much. You know, I lived for about 5 to 10, however, on and off, but I lived for almost a decade in Charlottesville, Virginia, after growing up in the Boston suburbs. And it was just a place with lots more Christianity and young people who had a lot of faith. And one thing I really admired was how much, because of the religion, like, just how much people were devoted to their neighbors. And there were just, landing in that community, there were more invitations to potlucks and picnics. And there was this intentional neighborliness that I sort of at some point thought, why is this place so friendly? And then I was like, it's Christ. Like, he's that sort of encouragement, you know. And I think all kinds of atheists and people who don't have faith are great too. But there is something, you know, I really admire that sort of counterintuitive.
I know what you're saying.
To be good to one another. That's
yeah,
in there. Yeah.
We don't do potluck. Now, one the key figure, and this is a sort of interesting biography of this person, and I want to talk about him a bit, is this David Starr Jordan. How did you come across him? Because that's it's a very obscure person.
Yeah,
and,
it is.
And most people have never heard of him before.
He's this obscure ichthyologist, biologist of fish, who was alive in the late 1800s, early 1900s. He was American. He was prolific at discovering tons of species of fish. And I just heard this little detail. I didn't even know it was him at first, but I heard that after the 1906 earthquake destroyed almost a whole, you know, just tons of an entire fish collection, I heard that the person in charge of them after the earthquake, instead of just sort of giving up, began the process of re-identifying all the fish that had been thrown from their jars and started sewing the label to the fish itself. Sort of.
And sometimes it was just a piece of a fish.
Yeah, exactly. And I heard that detail. I was on a tour of a science museum where some of the fish were held, and I actually, the tour guide took a fish out and tugged on the label, like still there over a century later. And there was just something about, in my head, that image of refusing to back down when chaos ruins your work and foils your order. There was just something really interesting to me about that. Like, I almost pictured an Icarus of the fish collection, just someone flying too high, trying to, you know, fight against chaos on this profession of order, which is, you know. And so I just wondered what became of him. That was all. I just wondered, if you fight chaos, do you end up humiliated? Do you end up successful? What becomes of that resilience? And so that's kind of...
Doesn't that, in fact, happen to him twice?
It does. So then that's...
So that seems insane to me.
That's me, too. too, that's when I started to really think, oh my gosh, this guy is like a parable for heathens. So before that, about 30 years before that, his first collection of fish was literally struck by lightning and burnt to the ground, every last specimen torched. And I just thought, you know, this guy, his profession is order, taxonomy, you know, the solving of how species are related to one another, trying to figure out the shape of the great tree of life. And his opponent and his life is plagued by chaos. And he just keeps going on and on and on, seemingly unfazed by all this destruction and failure. And so that's when, again, I sort of set out thinking, I'll just write a little essay. It'll be a meditative thing on man versus chaos.
Wow.
And then it just spiraled when I started looking into him, because the story gets so strange.
That's an understatement. Yeah. You start out and he wrote a memoir called The Days of Man. What was that like?
Oh my gosh. It is like the biggest positive self-congratulatory resume that has ever been written. It's almost 2,000 pages. It has to be broken into two brick-sized volumes. I mean, this thing is massive. It was stuffed with photos, which was really great, you know, from his entire life starting in childhood. But there were great, I mean, he's a really, at times, you know, sometimes it's just a bragathon of like, I briefly knew Teddy Roosevelt, or, you know, whatever, I won this prize. But then there are really great anecdotes, and he's a phenomenal writer. He writes, you know, about moments of fear or fun little hobbies he wants to get into, like when he was kind of teased as a little boy and was scared of the outside world for a little bit. He got really into the hobby of, quote, clasping his hands and jumping through them, trying to jump rope his own hands. And like, there's just so much. He writes about the natural world just beautifully. And so he was a great subject in that way, because it was filled with anecdotes and beautiful writing.
And let's talk about his childhood and his education. How did he get involved in natural history?
So he just, ever since he was a little boy, he was fascinated with the natural world, and he had this kind of impulse to name everything. So when he was a little boy, he wanted to figure out the names of all the stars, and he would go out at night and with an atlas, an astronomical atlas, and name the stars. And then he moved on to flowers, and he would pick flowers and tape them to his wall and write the names on the white walls, much to his mother's chagrin. Finally, you know, the more and more he worked at this, it just seemed like no one cared. His mom at one point threw out a bunch of the maps he had drawn. His school teachers didn't really care. He was having trouble getting a job after graduating from Cornell, because people were more interested in someone who could kind of command a lecture hall with a lot of bravado, and they kind of looked down on his crawling around in nature as child's play. Huh. And he wasn't doing very well. And then he heard about this summer camp being held on Penakeith Island out in Buzzards Bay by Louis Agassiz, the famous Swiss naturalist. And what Agassiz wanted to do was exactly what David loved, which is teach science out in nature.
I want to pause right there, because Penakeith Island is really, most people in Massachusetts probably don't even know where they are. But if you've ever been down, I think if you're in Westport and you look out in the water, those are them. There's a whole list of islands. There's a whole the Penakeith has a very weird history.
It does. It's this tiny little, it's kind of the runt of its island chain. It doesn't, depending on when you go, it doesn't have a tree. Sometimes it has one tree. but it's, you know, and it's shaped kind of like a little seahorse in the fetal position. It's this weird little scab of an island. It's tiny. It was a leper colony from 1906 to 1924. And before that, it was this place, you know, this summer camp for naturalists. And it's been a wildlife sanctuary. Then it was for 30 years, starting in the 1980s, it was a home to a reform school for boys. So it's like always been this little, almost just kind of lump or bump in the sea where people have gone to try to change or to kind of heal a vulnerable, you know, population. It's like this weird little salvation rock where things work or don't. I mean, people try. It's like an outpost of hope, I would call it. But
then, since it always changes, it's hope, but then failure.
Yeah, exactly. And it is it does. I mean, I talked to a woman who worked at the reform school, and then after that, it was a heroin recovery center, and then that shut down. But and I said, you know, does it feel cursed? Like, and she says, well, I look at all the years. You know, the school went for 30 years, and there were lives that were changed, and so she sees it as still hopeful.
Okay.
But I know it is hard from the outside not to see it as a failure. And actually, a detail I didn't include in the book was that the Agassi Barn, the school where this school where David's life would be transformed, was actually about 10 years after it shut down, was struck by lightning and burned to the ground as well.
Oh, my God. Now, let's talk about Louis Agassi for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was one of the first proponents of the Ice Age theory. So he was this really, he was kind of a celebrity scientist by his 40s and 50s. He had moved to teach at Harvard, and he was known for, he's got a lot of charisma, and he was known for basically putting students in a closet with like a tiny dead animal, a crab, a fish,
oh, yeah,
a rodent, and not letting them emerge until, quote, all the truths had been revealed. And he was just really passionate about it. And he had this motto, study nature, not books. And he was really wary. He thought a good scientist should be wary of beliefs, because any given theory or hypothesis was, you know, likely to be overturned, and that when you trusted too much in the accepted ideas of the day, you really made yourself vulnerable to ignorance, and that the best way to study, you know, to make progress in medicine and science, and even morality, in his opinion, was to look to nature itself, and that is how to be a good scientist. And he believed that waiting in nature, and he was a naturalist, and he believed that every species was a thought of God, and that waiting in nature was a divine hierarchy. And if you could figure out the ways in which creatures were ordered, who was higher than whom, you could begin to figure out clues of basically God's plan. And so he called the work of naturalism missionary work of the highest order.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Lulu Miller, a Peabody Award-winning science reporter and co-founder of NPR's Invisibilia. But we're talking about her new book. It's really, it's a great read. Why Fish Don't Exist, A Story of Loss, Love, and the Hidden Order of Life. Now, Jordan, David Starr Jordan gets to go to this class, July 8th, 1873. There's this lecture, this talk delivered by Agassi that seems to have been legendary. That literally changed his life.
It really did. His life just, he's sitting in a barn. He remembers there were birds flying in and out, and he was totally rapt. And that's where he was told that this hobby that he loved so much, you know, collecting flowers or fish in nature, that it had a purpose, and that to do that work was to figure out, you know, God's intentions and would be the path to progress. And it was the first person that told him this thing he did mattered. And he leaves the island, and after that his life just takes this upshoot. He gets a good job. He becomes a professor at Indiana University. Then very shortly after that, he becomes the president of Indiana University. About a decade after that, he's hired to become the first president of Stanford University. He has a wife, he gets children. I mean, he gets all these awards. He starts commissioning fish collecting expeditions all over the world. And while he will eventually break with this idea of a divine hierarchy, because he will come to accept the idea of Darwin and, you know, that everything was forged by chaos in that way, this notion that what he loved mattered, It just changed. I think about that idea, that the idea, you know, the feeling of purpose, it like inflated his chest. It really changed him. It gave him this confidence that made him able to accomplish so much.
And I'm not giving anything away, but there is such a dark side of that.
Yes. Yes.
Now, when you discovered that, and again, we're not going to reveal anything. As a person who's working on this, how did that make you feel emotionally? That to discover this thing, this person who you thought, you know, was this way, was a very different way.
Yeah, I mean, it was.
To me, it reminds me of when you're in a relationship and you realize the person you're with is insane.
Right. Well, it was, you know, I think that I went into it wanting him to be one or the other. You know, I went in, you know, there was a part of me that honestly did go in with trepidation, with this idea of, does someone who is so confident, you know, I had this idea, like I think most of us does, that there's something bad about hubris. There's something bad about overconfidence. You know, it will lead to evil, and it will lead to, or it might lead to humiliation. You know, the Icarus, the sun will melt your feathers, your wax and feathers. And so there was some question of, I always had a slight eyebrow raised of, are you a bad guy? And then when I found the just sheer breadth and depth of his cruelty and violence, what he was able to do, there was part of me that was like, yeah, see, confidence is bad. but what was really instructive to me, I think, was actually seeing when in his story things started to change, and trying to figure out, like, how did somebody who started out so gentle and curious about the world and wary of beliefs, how did he change? And I think for me, that was sort of, I started to see him really go bad when he started clinging to his beliefs and when he became certain, like that actually the certainty was more the culprit than the positive, than the confidence, if that makes sense.
It's an amazing story. And again, we're going to end talking about that right now, because I don't want to give away anymore. But one of the interesting things about your book is it's also about the evolution of taxonomy versus cladistics.
Yes, right.
And I lived through that. And that's a strange story. Taxonomy is like, goes back to Linnaeus, you know, when we're trying to like order all of nature, and you know, this belongs in this box and this belongs in that box. And then and then I love this term, the raving cladists showed up.
Yeah.
Now talk to me about cladistics. So how is that different?
Yeah. So there's, you know, the main puzzle of taxonomy is who is most closely related to whom, which seems like maybe a simple question, but that's the whole puzzle. That's so hard. How do you decide, you know?
That's right.
And with Linnaeus, the idea was, it was almost an there was a lot of intuition of, okay, these have scales and a pointy head, so they're probably close, you know. And then you would probably know this better than me, but taxonomy goes through all these revolutions of how we figure out who's closer to whom. And by the 70s, there was this thing in vogue called numerical taxonomy, where you would just, you'd use computers, use brute force and punch as many characteristics into the computer between two species, say. So if it was birds, it might be feather type and feather count and beak shape, and you know, just everything. And like the bone, you know, vertebrae and all the things. But when you removed human intuition entirely, you actually just got more nonsense. And so the cladists came on the scene around the late 70s, early 80s, and they had this insight that basically certain attributes of a creature or plant would be more useful clues. And those are what they called shared evolutionary novelties. So which is, you know, jargon for a new adaptation, a bright new yellow fin, something that was new. And if you could locate those on a creature, you could watch with more certainty which way the arrow of time was pointing, like how things were changing. So it was kind of this mix of intuition and I would say a little bit of numerical taxonomy. It was but that insight, it utterly changed the way that scientists saw the tree of life. And they realized there were all these relationships that seemed intuitive, which were actually wrong. And so, you know, you could talk about some of the ones you learned.
Well, the old taxonomists, they all looked at morphological characteristics. They all looked at like outside things. And as you mentioned, clearly, you know, if that looked like that shape and that looked like that shape on that thing, then those two things are similar. And the cladistics brought in a whole new way of looking at that. But the funny thing they thought, and this is true, is how you wrote about them in the book, is that they were sort of cocky and aggressive when they showed up, because they, you know, it's like, you've got it all wrong and we've got it all right. And they would do these things like say, okay, we have a cow, a salmon, and a lungfish. Which ones are related?
Right. And so they, and that one, you know, some unsuspecting biology student would say, well, a salmon and a lungfish are more closely related. You know, a lungfish, for anyone who doesn't know, it just looks like a very fishy fish. It's scaly, you know. And then the clatis would go on to show you how actually peel away that skin, so to speak, look inside, and you'll see a lungfish has lungs very similar to the cow, and the lungfish's lung has multi-chambers more similar to the cow, or to its heart, sorry, did I just say lungs? And it has an epiglottis, which is a little flap over the throat, and in all these other ways, a lungfish is way more closely related to a cow. And when you accept that, that actually a cow and a lungfish are more closely related, then you begin to see that the category of fish is totally bunk. It is not, you know, if you want to keep all things that look fishy together, like the lungfish and the salmon, and call that fish, you can do that, but you would need to include the cow, and you would need to include humans, and you would need to include birds. And so fish, the way we use it, looking at, you know, the scaly things in the water, is what taxonomists call paraphylic. It's basically a gerrymandered category that's missing crucial parts and has all these extra things in it, and it's a category you can make, but it would be like saying all animals that are striped are a category. It's fine. You can do it, but it's scientifically meaningless, or it's evolutionarily meaningless. And so that was like, you know, to me, I heard as I was starting to research David Starr Jordan's story, I read this beautiful book called Naming Nature by Carol Yoon, who lived through this shift. She was a biologist who lived through it. And just she spoke about the pain you and I were talking
The pain
about.
Of letting go fish.
Yeah, and just the pain of, I think more broadly, letting go of these intuitive categories we feel in nature. Like, it just feels ridiculous. People get irritated by the title of this book because it's like, fish exists.
Oh, God, yeah. Look at, I'll be honest. I was like, what?
Yes.
I was apoplectic.
I know. It is.
I purposely read the book to figure out what crap it was in.
Yeah, right. No, I know. And my publisher wanted me to change it, but I
no,
really
no,
hard
no, no,
because I'm
no.
like, I will deliver. I swear this is the...
You did. You did. That's right, all I can say. And we're out of time. So we're going to end right there. But all I can say is you did deliver, but it is painful. It is painful.
I think it matters. I guess this is all I'd say is I think it matters for people who are not taxonomists. Well, what I go on to do try to do in the last part of the book is really show why, like, letting go could change a life and just an everyday life and help a person maybe.
That's a beautiful section of the book too.
Thanks.
My guest tonight has been Lulu Miller, a Peabody Award winning science reporter and co-founder of NPR's Invisibilia. And we've been talking about her book. And if it's been like, we haven't really told you anything about it, that's why it's important to read a book. The book is Why Fish Don't Exist, A Story of Loss, Love, and the Hidden Order of Life, and Why Losing Fish Can Actually Mean Something to You. Lulu, it's been a pleasure.
So much fun. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.